This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we look at how one young man took action after the U.S. Treasury Department postponed long-awaited plans to put Harriet Tubman's image on the $20 bill. Continuing the legacy of using U.S. currency to transmit messages of social import, our guest Dan O'Wall devised an elegant campaign to keep Tubman's face in the public domain. Approximately 10 million Americans are victims of so-called revenge porn, and it hasn't been easy to get relief in the legal system. Attorney and author Carrie Goldberg is changing that with her law practice and her new book titled Nobody's Victim, Fighting Psychos, Stalkers, Pervs, and Trolls. Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. In 2016, the Obama administration announced plans to replace the image on the $20 bill from former President Andrew Jackson to Underground Railroad hero Harriet Tubman. The change was supposed to go into effect in 2020, the 100th anniversary of women's suffrage. But recently, Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin told the Congressional Committee that the stamp's debut would be delayed until 2026, citing the development of new security features. That leaves open the question of the redesign to a future presidential administration. Mnuchin claims that political considerations were not a factor, but current and former Treasury Department officials have said the bill's postponement is to avoid the possibility that President Donald Trump might cause an uproar by canceling it altogether. Across the nation, however, Americans don't have to wait to have a Tubman bill. Now available to all is the Harriet Tubman stamp, although not from the U.S. Postal Service. New York designer Dan O'Wall has created a do-it-yourself single-color ink stamp with Tubman's face to replace that of Jackson directly onto the bill. The stamps are available for purchase online. Putting someone's face on money is not considered defacing currency, as the only things that constitute defacing are cutting up a bill, putting two bills together, poking holes through the bill, or doing anything for the purpose of not being able to use that bill again. In the spirit of creative direct action, we are especially delighted to welcome the creator of the Harriet Tubman stamp, Dan O'Wall. Dan O'Wall, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
Dan O, we were thrilled to hear about your invention. Tell us, how did you come up with the idea of making a Harriet Tubman stamp?
This began in early 2017, shortly after Trump took office. Someone asked Steve Mnuchin what his plans were for the redesign of the $20 bill, and he sort of waffled about it, said that it wasn't a priority at the time. I took that to mean that it probably wasn't going to happen and was really distraught when it seemed to equivocate about putting her on the 20. So I sort of took that as my cue to interject with some art. And this honestly started more as a art project demonstration rather than a product that I'd be making thousands of. But I worked with a coworker to come up with the design. This was shortly after the photo of her from 1868 was discovered, the earliest known photograph of her. And so that sort of fit nicely timing-wise into the design. And we took it from there, played around with laser engraving, 3D printing, and a couple different designs before I landed on one that I really liked.
Now, let's tell our audience, you are a designer. That's what you do for a living.
Sort of. I work for an open source electronics company, so a lot of my day is manufacturing electronics, but I also do some design work and digital fabrication.
What was the response from your family and friends when you came up with the idea?
When I first got a stamp that worked really well, where all the features lined up with Andrew Jackson on the 20, right when I stamped the bill, I was sort of caught off guard by how powerful the image was of seeing her on the bill, because it really, it came off more convincing than I was expecting it to be. And as soon as coworkers, friends, family saw it, they all had the same reaction, like, oh, wow, wait, can I get one of those stamps? And so it quickly became this thing where I was just sort of making stamps as favors for people, because everyone sort of, as soon as they saw it, was like, oh, wait, this is important. This is powerful. This is a really nice stamp.
In terms of doing the actual creation, did you work from that photograph that was uncovered? And how did you fashion the likeness?
Yeah. I started with that photograph that's now part of the National Museum of African American History and Culture, and had to do some trickery to get an image of a $20 bill into visual editing software to work with to sort of extract the features from the bill that I needed. And then I laid those two on top of each other and scaled and rotated and aligned it until I got things to match up how I wanted.
And I'm holding in the studio a replica of a $20 bill that Dano got online, I understand. Mm-hmm. Did you have to, in that adjustment process, sort of distort Harriet Tubman's face to align with the eyes and nose and ears, or does that not matter when the stamp is actually put on?
I didn't have to do any distortion other than mirroring it so that her pose, the sort of three-quarters pose, matched Andrew Jackson. So it isn't an exact copy of the image because it is mirrored, but otherwise I didn't have to change anything. It was sort of by luck that newly discovered photo of her and the existing portrait on the 20 naturally line up pretty well together.
And we're going to actually try to do that in the studio, and we'll post some photos on our website of what the final product looks like. You used a 3D printer, is that correct?
Yes.
And when you realized this was popular, did you have to alter the way you manufactured it? Is it one by one, or how does that work now?
Yeah. It took a while to sort of scale up production to be where it needed to be. I was initially 3D printing because that allows you to really quickly iterate on prototypes. It's really useful in instances like that. But in this case, I'm making thousands, possibly tens of thousands, who knows how big it will go, stamps for which 3D printing really doesn't serve that need very well. And so the stamp that I brought in for us to use today is actually injection molded handle. So it's just solid plastic. It's very strong, a very simple object just to make very quickly. So the handle now is injection molded rather than 3D printed, which saves a lot of time. And the stamp face itself, I still make in the East Village with a guy, Casey Rubber Stamps.
Is that on 11th Street between, yep. I know that,
yeah.
Store?
He's been really helpful in just getting me through the manufacturing process of making these stamps. So he makes stamps in sheets of 12, just big sheets of rubber. I take those, trim them down, and then take them to a laser cutting facility, and they will laser cut out all the outlines for me. And then I take those home and attach them to the handles.
So this was a learning process for you.
Yeah. There's a lot of different stages to the manufacturing of the stamp. But I've come up with something that I feel like is reliable, good quality stamp. And I like being able to work locally where possible.
I love that East Village store, by the way. Now, do you need a special ink to adhere to the bill?
You don't. You can use pretty much any ink. American bills are made out of cotton, and so they take ink really well. This prop money that I brought in practicing is just regular printer paper.
Right.
But I've been using archival acid-free ink where possible because I think it lasts the longest, and you get a really good transfer. But American currency is very forgiving for whatever kind of ink you have.
Now, when you did this, did you know that it was not a legal offense to, pardon the term, deface a piece of U.S. currency?
No, I was under the same sort of misconception that I think most people are under, that marking currency broadly is illegal. in the course of the project, doing some research and hearing from different lawyers, I learned a lot more about Statute 333 that covers currency defacing or marring of currency or writing on currency. And it's surprising how specific the law is and how well fought the legal precedent already is.
The defacement has to actually impede the use of the currency.
Correct, yeah. Right. So if you cover up the text or the denomination or any of the numbers on the bill, that impedes its use as a piece of currency. And furthermore, there's some security features, seven distinct security features on a $20 bill that digital scanners will use to verify that it's a real piece of currency. The one that most people, I think, can quickly identify is that thin strip that's inserted into American currency on, I think, any bills over $1.
It has a sort of metallic sheen to
yes.
it. Yeah.
Yeah. But there's also watermarks and there's a little UV dot hidden on the bill. And I was careful to position the stamp so that it doesn't cover up any of those security features.
What I love about this, and I'll briefly describe it, it's a very elegant stamp, but it has a half moon indentation so that you can, to make sure you line up the face, you apply that half moon over the United States Federal Reserve System logo, I guess, on the left-hand
yeah.
side. Whoever looked at that before. Did that immediately come to you as a way of ensuring consistency?
Yeah, yeah. As soon as I started working on this, I realized that for it to work at all, rather than just inking up a bill and getting an image stamped somewhere on it, for it to align was essential for it to work. I tried a couple different features to get it aligned to the bill. I tried having it be the entire size of the bill, so it's just one stamp that is the same outline as a bill, but that is also a very large stamp and hard to use. And I tried using the small eagle as a way of aligning. But it was just simplest and most elegant to use the seal of the Federal Reserve that's just to the left of Andrew Jackson on the 20 as a way to know that you're positioning it correctly. And that way the eyes, nose, and mouth of Harriet Tubman line up with Andrew Jackson and you're not just inking up his face but actually replacing his face with hers.
Really beautiful design. Now, we talked about your friend's reaction. What have you heard from members of the general public as word about this spreads? Have you had any criticism?
There's been surprisingly little hate mail associated with the project. Early on, when I first published design online, there were some people on Thingiverse, the website where I put all the design files, and Twitter, who sort of got annoyed at it and, messaged me saying I was a communist or, other similar things that didn't really make a lot of sense to me. And I think that given my position, it's sort of my responsibility when interacting with people that aren't obviously trolls, who may genuinely misunderstand what I'm doing, to try and start a conversation with them, explain why I think this is important, the sort of history behind it, and why I think representation is important for everyone in America. That has, been sort of hit or miss. But I try to engage people who get upset about this because I think in some cases people are genuinely just misinformed and don't understand where this is coming from.
Have any educators come to you, say teachers of elementary or high school classes, to ask you to speak?
No, I haven't done any speaking engagements like that yet. I did send a package of 20 stamps to a library in California for African-American History Month as they were doing some event there. But otherwise, I've mostly just been focused on manufacturing them, making as many as I can.
How much of your time, roughly, does this take during a given week?
It's sort of like a second part-time to full-time job. I work a normal 40-hour week. And then I spend my evenings and weekends working on stamps.
Have you set a goal in terms of the numbers that you'd like to get into circulation of the stamp?
Yeah, initially when I started making these and when I decided I would sell them to sort of make the project self-sustaining, I had this lofty goal of making 5,000 stamps. That was an idea that another friend came up with, imagining that if you had 5,000 stamps and 5,000 people using those stamps, stamping 100 to 1,000 individual bills, that you'd be able to mark, you know, 4 to 5% of currently circulating $20 bills, which would really be at a level where it would be difficult for people to ignore or miss. And that, at the time, this was last fall, seemed like this impossible goal. At this point, in the intervening months, I've sold over 2,000 stamps, or gotten more, over 2,000 stamps out into the world. So it's seeming more and more possible that we could really build this into something that the U.S. Treasury would have to take notice of.
So part of the goal is to ensure that the idea of putting Harriet Tubman on the bill is not forgotten, but is it also to raise awareness around the nation?
Yeah. Yeah, it's both. It's the currency stamping campaign for social justice, basically.
In promoting the stamps on social media, the Instagram account refers to using the stamp as an act of civil disobedience. Did other acts of civil disobedience or any particular activists throughout history inspire you?
Yeah, I use the term civil disobedience sort of with a wink, because it's not really against the law to stamp money in this way, but it does feel subversive. So yeah, I often will post using the hashtag civil disobedience, because I think people respond to that and understand where that's coming from. In the, I think, early 1900s, suffragette pennies in the UK, where people would use a die and a hammer to stamp coins. And since then, there's been other stamping campaigns. In the 90s, there was a gay money stamping campaign. People would stamp, "This money has been handled by gay people." There's also been the Where's George stamping campaign, tracking $1 bills, which I was a part of when I was a teenager, stamping that on bills and tracking them. Ben and Jerry's has also had currency stamping campaigns and done money stamping on live TV. And there's other campaigns out there against using drones in war and stamping money out of politics. So this, I see this as fitting into that long history of using currency as a way to raise awareness and get a message out.
I actually collect some of the Where's George bills, because I didn't really discover that till a few years ago. For those of us who live in New York City, the website says there are two businesses that serve as, quote, stamping stations. What is a stamping station?
Stamping station is a business that has agreed to have a stamp on a tether next to its cash register with a ink pad that anyone is free to use. Actually, one of those businesses I have to go and visit because somebody stole the stamp that was installed there.
That's a good sign.
Yes, they're in high demand. So I have to go and fix their stamping station. But I've also been selling stamping station kits to people. So there's actually a list on the website, tubmanstamp.com, that has a list of all the different locations where people have set up stamping stations. If all you want to do is just stamp some money and don't feel you need the stamp yourself, you can just go to any of these stations. And they're in Michigan, around New York, on the West Coast.
That is so clever. What is the stampede? I read about that, I think, on the website.
Oh, Stamp Stampede?
Stamp Stampede, yeah.
Yeah, that's another currency stamping campaign.
To protest big money in politics?
Exactly, yeah.
Gee, the Occupy movement would have loved all these things. Dano, I'm curious, have you come across one of the bills in circulation?
I haven't personally yet, and part of the difficulty of a currency stamping campaign around $20 bills is that you so rarely receive a 20 as part of change. You'd have to be spending a denomination larger than a 20 to receive one back in most cases. So when I first started this, I thought it worked really well as an art project, but I wasn't very confident about how well the bills would actually circulate between people. But I've learned that you can deposit 20s into ATMs if you have an account with the bank. And digital scanners don't seem to mind when bills are stamped, unless they're, you know, really, if the stamp is really off, or if the ink is really soaked in, or if the bill itself is just difficult to read. So I have heard a few reports of people receiving stamped bills out of an ATM because the ATM will just disperse those bills back out. So it is possible for them to get into circulation and remain in circulation that way. And it's my understanding that unless somebody is physically examining money in a bank to look at what bills need to come out and be removed from circulation, that stamped currency would be passed by digital scanners and remain in circulation.
When you say digital scanner, are you talking about if I go into, say, a drugstore and I do the automated checkout where I put my bill into a machine?
Exactly.
Okay. So it doesn't reject the bill.
Yeah, yeah. If you have
a vending
machine that accepts 20s, some don't, some do. You can, you know, use a stamped bill in a vending machine. You can give it to the bank. And digital scanners don't seem to mind it, you know, 90%+ of the time.
So you've never had a bill returned by a bank teller, for example, if you hand them a deposit with a stamped 20?
I haven't personally given them to bank tellers. I have gotten a couple emails from people saying that when they took it to a bank, the teller wouldn't accept the stamped bills because they, like many people, are under the misconception that it's illegal to stamp currency. And so I've emailed with these people to sort of give them advice on the conversation you can have with the bank teller about history and you know, what is illegal regarding currency and what isn't. But it's really up to the individual discretion of a teller if they want to accept stamped currency or not. So there isn't really a good solution for that. Some people either wary to take it or don't approve of the mission behind it and will just not accept it on those grounds, unfortunately.
If you had a wish list of raising awareness even more and getting the stamps out so much that bank tellers actually would become used to seeing them, what would your goal for increasing the circulation of stamped bills? I run an activist center in Manhattan, and I'm imagining stamping parties. These are great gifts for socially conscious people.
Mm-hmm. The goal here really is for the Federal Reserve to take back the charge and actually make the switch from Andrew Jackson to Harriet Tubman. I think it's a change that's long overdue and would be a really significant symbolic act for our country, both in the story that we tell ourselves about who we are and what sort of nation we are, and also internationally to demonstrate to the world sort of what values we hold and what historical figures we celebrate. So I would like there to be so many stamp bills that the U.S. Treasury says, you know what, it's not worth it to fight this anymore. Let's just make the change. I believe that the new currency plates were designed and possibly already fabricated, and it just needs to, you know, be moved into production.
Interesting. Dano, if you don't mind a personal question, where did you grow up? Do you have a political background or socially responsible?
Not necessarily. I grew up in Salem, Massachusetts, and I guess my first act of civil disobedience, you could say, was when I was in high school. Salem is well known for its witch history. It also has a lot of other interesting history to it. It was a large port during the 1700s and was a big trading post. But when I was in high school, TV Land came into Salem, Massachusetts and installed just a few blocks from the house where I grew up, a statue of Samantha from the TV show Bewitched, which I thought was a mockery of both the tragedy of Salem, Massachusetts and the witch trials, but also totally ignored the very real and much more interesting, in my opinion, history of the spice trade. And so I went out in the middle of the night and spray painted all over the statue and wrote mockery on the ground in front of it because I was very upset that they did this.
Did you get in trouble for that?
No, no. I I suppose if my parents are listening, I'm sorry. They didn't know I did this. I wore all black and a mask. So that no one could identify me if there was a video. And it was cleaned up shortly afterwards. Nobody really seemed to notice. But I have had a sort of bent towards artistic resistance, I suppose. And this is the first project that has really taken off in the way it has.
We have in front of us, for those of you listening, I know you can't see, but we have some of these, what do you call them, mock bills?
Yeah, prop currency.
And we're going to actually stamp one. I just want to describe what it's like. I hate to be the first one to use this stamp.
That's all right.
Okay. So we have a beautiful stamp. They look like they're about, 2.5 inches square?
Mm-hmm.
Listeners, we have three crisp fake $20 bills. So is all the equipment in your apartment, or do you have a studio?
No, I do all the finishing and the packaging in my apartment, and then the manufacturing of the stamps, the handles, and the stamp rubber happens elsewhere. We've got this loaded up with ink.
And Dana was lining it up. Oh, that's amazing.
You can see it.
This is beautiful. She's so regal on this.
Yeah, you're free to.
How many tries would you say before you settled on the final stamp?
This is probably fourth or fifth iteration of the design. I really decided I'd.
Oops, I already botched it. I'm a little outside. Oh, yeah, I ruined this one. Sorry. I guess that's what practice is for.
Yeah.
How mad is it?
How not to do it,
yeah,
right?
You really have to press down pretty hard. To.
When you're lining up the half circle, do you tilt the stamp up to keep the ink off, or do you just...
I just go straight down.
You go straight down. Okay, there is a technique, listeners. How can listeners get this stamp?
Yeah, I have been selling stamps on Etsy. They sell out fairly quickly whenever I put them in stock, so I try to restock my shop once a week. I'll put as many in as I can, and if people aren't able to get one while they're in stock, you can sign up to be notified when they go back in stock through Etsy.
Do you do the actual mailing yourself?
I do.
So you are a full-service shop from production, manufacturing, distribution, and then customer service.
Yeah, I've kept it as simple as I can from the start, in part because part of the mission of the project is to raise money for charity. I don't think it's appropriate for someone like me who has a separate job to be making money off of something that is, you know, has this long history of pain and trauma for the African American community. And I don't think it's appropriate to sort of use Harriet Tubman's legacy, which is really admirable, to be making money for myself. So I do this all on my own without having to hire other people to do the shipping and distribution, just as a way to keep it simple, keep the finances as basic as possible, and then, you know, set aside whatever's profit and donate that to various charities.
And you select different charities?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I started donating to some of the large recognizable charities at first, the Southern Poverty Law Center and ACLU, Planned Parenthood, but I found some other charities that are smaller, and I think where a small amount of money can really go far. Dig Deep Water makes wells for people who are living on reservations that don't have access to clean drinking water. The Dudley Street Neighborhood Initiative is a nonprofit in Boston that helps sort of revitalize the neighborhood and community there. Sister Song fights for reproductive justice and is a mostly women-run organization. So I've been trying to find smaller charities like that to support, because in the amount of money that I'm giving, which is $500 to $1,000 usually at a time, I think that amount of money can make a difference for a small organization like that.
That's very true. Dano, unfortunately, we're running out of time, but I have to say that you are amazing. Thank you so much for this public service. We wish you the best of luck. We're going to help spread the word, and we really want to stay in touch and hear how this campaign is going.
Thank you. Sounds good.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org. In January 2019, New York State passed a bill to outlaw revenge porn, joining 41 other states that have passed similar laws. Revenge porn is the term for the non-consensual sharing on the internet of sexually explicit photos or videos. Victims say it can be as damaging as any other form of abuse, but without the same legal protections. Private images can follow victims around for years, turning up when employers or romantic partners search for their names on the internet. But in New York, victims have experienced years of helplessness in the courts. Prosecutors could not charge offenders for a practice that was not illegal, and judges turned down appeals for help on the grounds of free speech, even as other states were enacting protections. Under New York's new law, offenders can be punished for up to 1 year in jail. The law also allows victims to sue the person who shared the revenge porn, which about a dozen other states also allow. Most people have heard about high-profile instances of sexual images used as blackmail or revenge, involving the rich and famous, such as singer Rihanna or actor Jennifer Lawrence. But this affects millions of people, from middle school students to Marines, and as many as 10 million Americans have been victims of revenge porn. Joining us today is New York attorney Carrie Goldberg. Herself a victim of revenge porn, she started a law firm in the city to focus on defending victims of the practice. She has just come out with her new book, Nobody's Victim: Fighting Psychos, Stalkers, Pervs, and Trolls. Carrie Goldberg, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. I am very happy to be here.
Well, congratulations on your book, Nobody's Victim: Fighting Psychos, Stalkers, Pervs, and Trolls. And we're going to talk about that in a minute. But I want to ask you first, how do you define revenge porn?
Well, revenge porn is the non-consensual distribution of sexually graphic images and videos. So it's kind of a colloquial term that was picked up by the media, but revenge isn't really a necessary requirement. People and our clients, we represent many victims of non-consensual porn, which is what we call it in the office. And there, you know, we have some clients who, yes, you know, a jilted ex-boyfriend posted images of them, sexual images, to the internet and to websites for revenge. But in other cases, you know, our clients are young girls who maybe pictures of them are passed around school, you know, for the entertainment of their peers. Or we represent celebrities whose pictures have gone viral, not because there was necessarily malicious intention in doing that, but just because, you know, the offenders were, you know, hacked in or were getting paid or all sorts of other non-revenge reasons.
Now, how does this relate to stalking? Are they separate? Are they related?
So stalking is, it's a course of conduct that results in somebody fearing for their life. So oftentimes, revenge porn is one tactic that stalkers take, especially when stalking occurs after the end of a relationship. We've had cases where a stalker might start by posting naked images of his ex on the internet, and then his dangerous behavior escalates to the point in one of our cases where he was impersonating our client and making bomb threats to Jewish community centers all over the country. It's one of many traits that we see commonly in stalking. We rarely see cases of stalking that don't involve the exploitation of the internet.
Now, what do you say to critics who, and I think I read this recently in the New York Times letter section, say, well, you shouldn't have taken naked photos. What do you expect? Do you get that a lot?
I do, and I used to when I first started my firm in 2014, before people even knew that there was this injury of spreading people's most humiliating moments online. And over the years, we get that less and less because our country and a lot of the world, and I think the UK, they've passed legislation to criminalize revenge porn. And so when our law enforcers and our laws step in to say, hey, this behavior is so bad that we're actually going to be regulating it with our criminal laws, then it kind of shows that it's time to stop blaming victims. We wouldn't blame a victim of a robbery for, you know, that's what you get for having a home. Your possessions were stolen, so that's what you get for having, you know, that nice TV and artwork. We can't be blaming victims. And that's also very important when we think about the way that the humiliation type of crimes have been evolving, where we now have deep fakes, which is kind of like synthetic porn, where I can use AI to manipulate porn videos so that it looks like your head is actually on the porn actress's body. And that, you know, so anybody actually can become a victim, regardless of whether they've taken pictures and shared them.
Good point. And the viewing audience does not know that.
Exactly. And I think it also just comes down to basic consent. You know, consenting to share images with one person in context of an intimate relationship is not consenting for them to share it with the rest of the world. And we, you know, it's 2019, and we do everything with our phone and everything with the internet. It's how we shop. It's how we date. It's how we communicate with our loved ones. It's how we set up appointments. So, of course, it's going to be how we mate and date and express, you know, intimacy. So there's nothing perverse or obscene about you know, just the basic of taking a naked picture. It's what's obscene is sharing it without the consent of the depicted person.
One study that I read estimates that up to 10 million Americans have been victims of revenge porn. Why don't we hear more about this? It's clearly an epidemic.
That's a great question. I hear a lot about it because that's what my law practice is devoted to. It's all people who've been sexually dominated and whether online or offline. You know, I maybe have a little bit of a different perspective because I'm constantly dealing with it. But one of the purposes of my book is for people to know that it's a thing, and for people in the UK, in the US, and anywhere else to realize that there is this domination of other people not just through physical domination, but also through manipulation via tech.
Psychological online manipulation.
Yeah, I mean, is there
a profile, Carrie, of a typical offender? I understand that a large number are indeed men dominating women.
So, in the book, I mean, one of its purposes is to kind of demystify the offenders, because we deal with so many different kinds of offenses, and all of our clients are people who've been attacked or are under attack. We see these character behaviors of the offenders emerge over and over again. And so we've created this taxonomy of offenders, and we have a-holes, psychos, pervs, and trolls. And each of those categories has kind of a different set of behavioral traits. And it's almost as if they have a playbook for it. The a-holes are people who are acting maliciously but have a certain level of self-control and can be stopped, at least with an order of protection or a cease and desist letter. The psycho is somebody who is engaging in stalking behavior that we've had no success in stopping without the intervention of criminal law enforcement. And pervs are people who are dominating and preying on our clients sexually, whether that's through sextortion or through offline sexual assault. And then the trolls, the remaining category, are people who mainly are aggressing online. So they might be the people that are organizing through 8chan to all gang up on a feminist reporter, for instance.
Carrie, in the book, you very honestly talk about your own experience and how you were propelled really to take control, take action. You formed your own law firm. Would you mind sharing a little bit about your experience for our listening audience?
Yes, I will talk a little bit about that. In 2013, the beginning of 2013, I was kind of I fell into this whirlwind romance with somebody, and he just kind of knocked me off my feet. And after a couple weeks, it kind of became, it went from, oh my gosh, you know, I found somebody who's obsessed with me, to, oh my gosh, this man's obsessed with me. And he was immediately really controlling and scary and jealous and would gaslight me. And when I, after a couple months, when I tried to get out of the relationship, he just went on this scorched earth attack on me, threatening to send intimate pictures of me to my colleagues and my boss. And then he would actually emailed me those pictures and say those people were blind copied. He reached out to like 16 of my friends and family members and spread lies to them about me having STDs and being pregnant and a drug addict. He made false police reports and I got arrested. And then he was making all these threats to the point that I moved out of my home. And it was just nothing in my life was the same. I tried to get the police involved, and they told me to go to family court. When I went to family court, they told me that he had a First Amendment right to do a lot of the behavior that he was doing. And I had so much trouble finding anybody who could help me. I, you know, had the advice of a couple lawyers, but this was like nothing they'd ever seen before. And so when my ordeal was over, when the bogus criminal case against me were dropped and he pled guilty to criminal charges and I got an order of protection, I left my job. I was already a lawyer, but I was working with elderly people. And I started my law firm, and that was in January of 2014, about a year after I began the relationship with him. And my whole purpose is basically to become the lawyer that I'd needed. And, you know, now we, you know, it's really rewarding to have somebody come to us when they're in sort of their storm of hellishness, and they think that they're the only person that's ever gone through anything like that, like this, and they're terrified. And it's really great to be able to say, we know what to do. We've seen this kind of behavior, and this is what works to stop it. Or we have these relationships with law enforcers who will, you know, who are really good at the forensic evidence analysis that we'll need to get him arrested. You know, to have all the connections and to not be having to, like, learn what to do, as my lawyers had to do when I was dealing with it.
In your book, you reference an excitement that you had when your clients reached a point where they switched from being a victim to getting angry and wanting to take action, which relates obviously to the title of your book, Nobody's Victim, and Fighting Back. Does that happen with most of the clients that you see?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a really important trait to the client experience, because it's not easy to go through not just the stalking, but also the procedure of getting legal relief. And it's really important to me that you know, that the procedure of getting help is not a nightmare for a client. And so if I can, you know, help them reframe it as, okay, you are now a warrior. You're done being a, you know, like, let's convert you from being a victim to a warrior. And now we have this legal challenge together to go through the bureaucracy and the morass of the legal system. And that's going to be part of the challenge now. And you have a little army of lawyers that are here to help you. It can actually, you know, it can be a really rewarding fight when we are embarking on some of the lengthier cases. I mean, we have some cases where it's all about getting the content off the internet, or, you know, there's not as much activity for the client. But if it's a big litigation, you know, I want to make sure that they're in it for the fight and that they're angry and that they're propelled, because that's what will keep them motivated. Because they're leaders. There aren't that many victims that will you know, take action. And so I want them to see themselves as pioneers.
New York State recently passed a law to protect victims of this kind of crime, joining what I understand is a majority of other states. Who opposed this law, Carrie?
We first introduced this law 5 years ago. At the time, New York could have been one of the, like, third or fourth states to criminalize non-consensual pornography. And for 5 years, our lawmakers did not vote in for this law. And in those 5 years, like, almost, like, 40 states passed laws. And so New York finally became the 46th state. So it was a combination of our lawmakers not caring enough about sexual privacy. And then last year in 2018, when it was about to pass, our Senate got spooked by Google's lobbyists that came out of nowhere and did something to intimidate them on the last day of the session to not even vote on the bill. And so we are actually up against big tech. And they hide behind the lobbyists that they pay millions of dollars to so that they never have to deal with, I mean, until they met me, you know, that they never have to deal directly with these really kind of socially unpopular and misogynistic policies that they have. You know, just Google, for instance, is the cause of most people who've been the victims of revenge porn's harm. Their Google results are destroyed. You know, the first pages of their search engine results, when they type their name in, lead to revenge porn. That makes it really hard to get a job or a date or even a roommate. Nobody does anything without typing, you know, without checking somebody's Google results. And so then on top of that, for Google to oppose the criminal law safety measures available to victims, it's disgusting. And they need to be held, you know, accountable for what their lobbyists are doing.
How difficult, if I woke up one morning and saw a private photo on a Google search of myself, how hard is it for me to get that image removed? And how long does it take?
Well, so Google now has a quote-unquote ban on revenge porn, which basically just means, you know, in their terms of services, that they have the discretion to choose. They may choose to remove a link to revenge porn from somebody's search engine results. But it's completely at their discretion. And so there's a form, which you can find on my website, deep in Google, where you can request removal. But even from your search engine results, but that's not going to remove it from the URL where it's actually posted. For that to be removed, you'd actually have to contact that website and, you know, either just make a sort of bleeding heart request that they remove the picture. And if it's a revenge porn website, they're probably not going to be very motivated to do so. Or you can claim that, you know, if you own the copyright of the picture, if it's a selfie, you can claim that. A lot of our clients, their pictures first appear on porn sites like Pornhub, which has billions of monthly viewers. And so when a site goes up somewhere like that, just because of the sheer volume of visitors to those sites, they tend to go viral very quickly. And so the removal process is much lengthier because any single person who viewed the image could theoretically download it and then repost it, even if we got it taken down from one place. It can then kind of pop up somewhere else. It depends on how quickly you've become aware of the picture and how quickly you take action.
Or the video.
Or it's been spread.
Right.
Or the video, yes.
Carrie, have you noticed a difference in the last few years with heightened awareness of mistreatment of women from the Me Too movement and other news developments? Have you noticed a difference in the courtroom in terms of judges and attorneys' sensitivity and awareness of the scope of this problem? Or is it getting easier for your clients?
Nothing's easy for my clients. There's still a lot of bias suggests that if they're getting legal, they're pursuing justice, then they must be gold digging or opportunists or pawns in, you know, somebody's Me Too legal agenda, or, you know, man haters, and so there's always that bias to overcome. I've been in court more and more, and particularly in our criminal cases, where the courts are the judges, and so far they've always been male. Who've done this have gone on lengthy screeds against the offenders during sentencing, where our clients have delivered really passionate victim impact statements about what they've endured, and then after that, the judges have given pretty severe sentences and expressed just absolute outrage at the arrogance that the offenders have shown. Because almost always they say, oh, I deeply regret having done this. If I could, you know, it was a mistake. And most of the stalking cases that we deal with, and those are the ones that I'm talking about here, it's so many repeated actions, you know, over a course of time. And so to say that it was a mistake, oh, I fell on my computer 10,000 times and sent revenge porn and made these impersonating accounts claiming that my victim's a child pornographer. You know, like, the judges aren't buying it, that this conduct is possibly a mistake. If there's regret, they regret getting caught.
Carrie, we just have a few minutes remaining. I want to say that your book is hard-hitting and really a page-turner. There's a story about a client where I believe the ex had other individuals commit criminal acts against him that was quite horrifying. How do you deal day in, day out with this kind of case and maintain, you know, a healthy mental attitude about it?
Thank you for asking that. Every day is a different kind of emotional roller coaster, but it helps to have an amazing staff. So I've got now a staff of 13. I'm not dealing with this on my own, and neither are my staff members, and so we can all support each other. I believe a lot in just surrounding yourself by beauty, and I've got a beautiful office, and we've got good-smelling candles and a nice view, and, you know, and I think exercise can be a really great healing, energizing tool. So a lot of just the way of handling this kind of boils down to just support and aesthetics, you know, having comfortable furniture and flowers in the office, good snacks.
Because let's face it, you are dealing with individuals who have been quite literally traumatized.
Yeah, I agree, and that sounds like it would be very heavy to be dealing with that day in and day out, but we're also solving problems, and so there's a little bit of an emotional removal that comes with looking at the problem analytically and thinking, okay, I know how to solve this, and you can still be very you have great deep emotional relationship with your client, and yet have some distance. And for me, there's a lot of just joy in knowing how I can solve somebody's hell. We have our marching orders, okay? Somebody's being stalked. We need to go through the evidence. We need to identify, you know, what IP information we need or figure out the core. You know, there's so many just, like, tasks that have to be done, and that can be very, that can be a very, like, organizing way to handle things emotionally, too.
I want to read, before we close, a brief review of your book. One reviewer said, in her decade as a victims' rights lawyer, Carrie Goldberg has seen it all. A man who made fake bomb threats in his ex-girlfriend's name, a 15-year-old who was sexually assaulted at school and suspended when she reported the crime, a man who used a dating app to send 1,200 men to his ex's home. The resulting book details how to take control and protect yourself. And the reviews are just all glowing. Congratulations on this magnificent book, Nobody's Victim. Is it out in bookstores now, Carrie?
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's a question?
Yes.
It is out in bookstores now. It it released in U.S. bookstores yesterday on August 13th.
Great.
And UK and internationally tomorrow.
Fabulous. So by the time this airs, it will be out everywhere. The publisher is Plume Books. I would recommend this book highly to anyone who is concerned about what I think is an epidemic.
Yes, and I would recommend it to people who, you know, have kids that are in high school and college. I think it's a really important tool for them to stay safe and to stay aware. I think awareness is the number one thing that we can, you know, teach our children, and empathy to both sons and daughters. You know, if people understand what victims are going through, I think they're less likely to victimize and less likely to victim blame.
And also to not be filled with shame if you are the victim of this.
Completely. Completely. And the whole point is to transfer the shame from the victim to the offender.
Well, Carrie Goldberg, if anyone can inspire others to do this, it is you. We want to thank you so much for your amazing work and congratulate you again on your book.
Thank you. It's such a privilege to be on Law and Disorder, so thank you very much.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.